We're good to go.
Great.
We're good to go.
Good to go. Hello, everybody. Hi, everyone in the Zoom room who's just joined, and hi, everyone who's watching
We're good to go.
on various streams. So, yeah, Chris and Lisa and John
Great.
and
We're good to go.
Jamie,
Good
if
to
you
go.
could,
Hello, everybody. Hi, everyone in the Zoom room who's just joined, and hi, everyone who's
apologies.
watching on.
Right.
Good to go. Good to go. Hello, everybody. Hi,
Sorry,
everyone in the
guys.
Zoom room.
I've just got myself into
No
a horrific circular moment there of streams crashing. So if you could put yourselves on mute if you're in the actual Zoom room, that would be good. I think most people are. That's great. And if Egon, if you could help with that, that would be great too. So amazing. Yeah. So Chris and Lisa and John, if you could turn your cameras on, that would be fantastic. Cool. Yeah, so welcome everybody. Thank you for being here, whether you're here in the Zoom room or whether you're tuning in on one of the streams. So I've been really looking forward to this. This is the online launch of my new book, Bigger Picture: How Psychedelics Can Help Us Make Sense of the World. And for this, what I wanted to do is bring together some really brilliant people who have inspired me in different ways, and also who each hold kind of a different piece of the puzzle that I explore in the book. So the book is really, instead of how to change your mind, really focusing on how to change society. And of course, that's a pretty big question to be asking, and requires a real engagement with the complexity of the psychedelic experience, and also the complexity of the times that we live in. So what we're going to do here is going to introduce the speakers as well. I'm going to also after that do a short reading from the book, and then open up a conversation, and I'll facilitate a conversation between who we have here. Lucy Walker is hopefully on her way. She was filming today in France and might have been waylaid, but hopefully if she joins, then we'll loop her into the conversation as we go. So first off, yeah, so there's a kind of really interesting mix of guests here. Just to describe why. So the way that I've structured the book is probably about 75% of it is looking at really big picture concepts, looking at where the state of the world right now, where we are, and the ways in which psychedelic experiences and what we're learning from psychedelic science can help us make sense of it more effectively. Also, what's in there is my own experiences from a really innovative trial run at Imperial College called the DMT Extended State Trial. And that was run by Chris Timmerman and Lisa Luan. And they're both here today. So we're going to be talking about that as well, and talking about what I think is probably one of the wildest and most fascinating scientific studies into the mind that's going on right now, or has recently just finished. And if Lucy manages to join us, Lucy is a very accomplished filmmaker, but was also a participant on the trial. So I think she'll also be able to speak to some of her experiences. We have John Verveke, who's a cognitive scientist at the University of Toronto. And I think John is quoted or referenced more than any other thinker in the book. So John, as always, it's a great pleasure to have you here. And likewise, Jamie Wheel, best-selling author of Ceiling Fire and Recapture the Rapture. He is also referenced a lot. Jamie and I have talked a lot about the complexities of psychedelic mainstreaming over the years, and I really value Jamie's no-holds-barred perspective on not just psychedelics, but also different states of consciousness and how society kind of engages with them. So I thought I'd quite like you guys to just maybe introduce yourselves a little bit, and perhaps start with Chris and Lisa, and maybe just a minute or so, just maybe a short introduction to yourself, and also this question of how psychedelics can help us make sense of the world and engage with the world more fully. Maybe your own personal thoughts on that. So, Chris, since your box is right beside me, maybe you could kick us off.
Sure. Hi everyone, and thanks, Sally, for having me, and also having Lisa in the virtual panel. Do you call it a virtual panel?
We can, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, so I'm Chris. I lead the DMT research group at Imperial College London, where also Lisa works. I'm a neuroscientist and a psychologist by training, and my fundamental interest, my main sort of quest in this whole thing of research, is about consciousness and how we can better understand the mind and the brain, especially using psychedelics. Psychedelics and some meditation research have been going on into it a bit lately. So within this quest, if you will, we started to do experiments with DMT. I think some of the first investigations since the seminal work from Rick Strassman in the 90s. And, you know, we've been really trying to see how we can get a better understanding of what's happening in these states by employing advanced neuroimaging techniques, putting people in fMRI scanners and recording EEG activity, while at the same time giving pretty big doses of DMT. And as of late, and more relevant to this specific panel, we have started to do this work of extending that DMT state. And this is the work that Lisa has been leading in the past years, in which Ali participated. And when it comes to the question, how is it that psychedelics can make us can help us make sense of the world? Is that the how they can help us make sense of the world? I think fundamentally, for me, the way that I see it is that psychedelics provide means for us to understand how we are constantly immersed in worlds of experience, how we are constantly convinced of the meaningful worlds we inhabit. But that sort of mechanism appears to be very much invisible to us from day-to-day life. We just navigate through life with a naive sense that this space that we inhabit is reality. So when you have a strong modulator of reality, such as DMT, a strong modulator of consciousness, I think with proper practice, with proper mediation, with proper scaffolding, we can also become aware of how we are always immersed in different worlds of experience and how a big part of our life, that mechanism is fairly invisible. So I think in that sort of mediation, in that sort of transition between reality, states of consciousness, and so on, we can find ways of making meaning out of different ways, different forms of reality, and also how we can find inspiration, which I think is really at the basis of potentially mental health and a range of other sort of interesting aspects and relevant aspects to life and mind.
Wonderfully said. Thank you, Chris. And then Lisa, same question, really, maybe a little bit about yourself, and then also that question.
Yeah, so as Chris already said, I'm working in the psychedelic research group as well, more specifically in the DMT research group, and have been for 3 years now. So I've been mostly leading the DMT extended trial for the past years. And I guess when I think about how psychedelics can help us make sense of the world, I guess it kind of, for me, it comes down to their potential to show us a new way of looking at things. So like new or different perspectives or a new way to understand things, with the things in question ranging from ourselves, our relationships to other people, our lives, and I guess in a way also our reality. That's kind of the gist of it.
Wonderful, a great gist. Thank you. And then Jamie, great to hear a little bit about you and your take on this bigger question.
Sure. I mean, I think for me, the one I constantly come back to is just this seemingly baffling paradox that psychedelics change everything and nothing. And how do we live between those two things? You know, they do not absolve us of the human condition. They don't do our laundry or find a good job or solve our family dysfunctions. They might provide some insights, but we still have to do this human thing. And so balancing that against the sort of inflated, frothy expectations of this current psychedelic renaissance is just always one of my curiosities, and just like, aha, what exactly is this? And I think it might be, I might have even, you and I might have even had this conversation last week, Ali, which was just, it almost feels like a salt deficiency in animals, you know, and how they have to go and find a salt lick to restore. Like, it's almost like we have a mystery or awe deficiency in our postmodern Cartesian world, you know, which bringing up the threshold works absolute wonders for our systems. Mainlining it after that gives us hypertension, you know, and a heart attack. And so there's just something in the sort of, when it is deficient, adding it is game changing. When it is sufficient, adding it actually becomes, you know, a dis-ease of its own. I think to Chris's and Lisa's work, I mean, I'm extra especially geeked on your guys' particular project, because I think that, you know, I would hold that, never mind what happens with the psychedelic renaissance and the medicalization, you know, the sort of pharmacological therapeutic models. I think they are on the tracks they're on and going to go exactly where you would imagine if you know anything about market economics and perverse incentives and multipolar traps. But, right, what telescopes are to astronomy and microscopes became to biology, I think psychedelics are to psychology and philosophy. And our capacity to harness them to radically advance theories of mind, consciousness, being, selfhood, and the neurobiological underpinnings is second to none and super exciting. And then, you know, to go back to this study, and I wrote about this both in Stealing Fire and Recapture the Rapture, because I sat down to dinner in London with the original funders and potential, I don't know where David is on this project now, but, you know, heard this original pitch back in 2019. And I was like, this is mayhem. Like, what are you, you're like a dog chasing a car. Like, what are you going to do when you latch onto the bumper? Like, if you really are trying to contact entities and you really are trying to do, you know, test for telekinesis and or time bending, et cetera, like what's going to happen to those poor bastards if it works? You know, you're going to need a sort of SEAL Team 6 of hyperspace, not simply somebody who's tripped at Coachella or Glasto a few times, you know, so, but the capacity to have authentic, replicable experiences of the non-ordinary and then cross-map them with other users and subjects so that each epiphany isn't just a Joseph Smith or an Elijah coming down from the mountain, hair on fire, and no one can ever falsify or repeat the experiment. The capacity for us to start mapping the physics of the metaphysics via these kinds of studies, I think, is super, super interesting and could open up an entire, you know, new ontology on what it, you know, basically a non-anthropocentric, non-geocentric ontology of life, the universe, and everything.
Amen. Thank you, Jamie. Yeah, that's actually, and that last bit in particular is also one of the things I think is most promising about psychedelics, if we can get it right, which is no easy task, is that deeper shift in how we view reality. So John Fervaeke, it'd be great to hear from you.
I agree with Jamie. I think we're in a deficit situation, and I've done work on that. I'm not going to make these arguments again about that we're in a meaning crisis and we have lost a sense and a sensibility and an ability to make sense of experiences that used to be taken under the sacred canopy. I think psychedelics are interesting because they... as many people have said, they've altered how we're framing the world and filtering the world. I'm interested in how psychedelic experiences fit onto a larger continuum of experiences, insight, flow, mystical experiences, transformative experiences. And I'm ultimately most interested in the last of these. I'm not particularly interested in most of the phenomenology that comes out of psychedelic experiences. I'm much more interested in the functionality. Are there any long-term modifications to cognition? Are there any ways in which those experiences translate into the acquisition of character traits, the cultivation of virtue and wisdom? Because I think those are what is needed today. We already have a culture that's saturated in intense experiences. I think that these psychedelic experiences, especially like in the Griffiths Lab and others, where they carry over into mystical experiences, and then for some people, Yaden's work, those carry over into transformative experiences. I think that holds a real potential. I think there's a real danger in psychedelics, and I think Jamie was pointing towards that, which is, again, we can confuse a very phenomenologically intense experience with something that has a special epistemological privilege. Human beings have been making those kinds of claims for millennia, and we are rightly suspicious of them. And I don't think just because they're psychedelic experiences that we should throw down our epistemic caution. I think psychedelics can be an avenue for altering what people find salient and relevant, and that can be the beginning of a pathway, a sapiential pathway towards the cultivation of wisdom. I think psychedelics also can alter your salience landscape and afford people to go down rabbit holes of self-deception and narcissism and spiritual materialism and all kinds of other evils. And so my most pressing concern, well, I have two. One is a cognitive scientist. I just want to know what the hell's going on in the brain and the mind when psychedelics are happening. The anthropic brain and reduction of overfitting hypotheses, I think, are very interesting. And they do hold the potential to theoretically integrate with other work on problem solving and cognition. But if we're talking about the bigger picture, for me, the bigger picture is, how can we wed that scientific understanding to a proper development and and promotion of a sapiential context that properly situates the use of psychedelics for, right, the cultivation of virtue and wisdom, and not for the affordance and promotion of ways in which people can rabbit hole, become narcissistic, become evangelists of their own particular idiosyncratic metaphysical worldview, all of these things of which also do happen. So that's me and where I come from at this.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you, everybody. And yeah, that's a very important aspect of this entire question for me as well. And I kind of dedicated a whole chapter to, for want of a better word, the dark side, or the way psychedelics can narrow our frame on the world. Because I think anyone who has spent any time in psychedelic communities has seen that happen firsthand. So to fathom hell or soar angelic, you need a pinch of psychedelic, as the phrase goes. It really flies both ways. So I'm going to, we're going to come back, and I have questions for each of you, and then I'm hoping we can kind of weave together a few different perspectives. I'm going to do a short reading to give a sense of how I've approached these questions in the book, and also touch a little bit on one of my experiences, or part of my experience, in the DMT extended state trial, which of course was absolutely fascinating. And you know, something I want to caveat beforehand, which I talk about in the book, is that what we glean from our own subjective internal psychedelic experiences, we can't necessarily just come back to the world and make truth claims about, right? So the reason I put them in the book is very deliberately to give a single qualitative experience of what was a very unique trial, and a very unique experience, and very meaningful one for me. But I want to also, you know, John mentioned this, you know, this idea of taking truth claims from our deep transformative experiences is hugely problematic. So we have to be very careful how we do that. So I'm going to, let's see, bear with me one second. Just open this. This is the lovely bit where we do have a technical moment. Apologies, I've now entered a kind of technical vortex where I can't see my own screen. There we go. Let's see if we can manage to get this to work. Okay. I just get a little thumbs up if people can see that effectively. Yeah, see that? Great. So now let's see if, while I do this, if I could also just get a thumbs up in a moment, if you can actually see the presentation. Is that okay? Can you see Mickey Mouse there? Yeah, great. Okay. So I'm going to read from from the third chapter in the book, which is a chapter all about the internet, because I make the argument that the skills that help us navigate a psychedelic experience can be applied to the way we navigate our increasingly high salience, very complex and intense online landscape. So, like the sorcerer's apprentice, who plays with forces beyond his control while the magician is away, what we have unleashed with the internet isn't something we can now reverse. A 2021 study revealed that nearly two-thirds of people surveyed believed life was better before social media platforms, and 42% of Gen Z respondents said they felt addicted to social media and couldn't stop if they tried, even though depressed, angry, and alone were the most common words they associated with Facebook, while missing out and alone were the words most commonly associated with Instagram. We increasingly share a sense of alienation and loneliness online. What seems to be lacking is a true sense of intimacy and authentic connection. The resulting implications were key themes in my second dosing during the trial, and what I experienced would lead me to reevaluate the consequences of our disconnection and alienation online. My second dosing took place 2 weeks after my first non-placebo experience. As soon as the DMT entered my veins, I was once again plunged into the same cavern I had entered on the first dosing, encased in a large geometric sphere. I had a sense that I was in a kind of holding area, and superimposed against it was a playground I had walked past a few weeks before. The fact that it came to mind was in itself very strange, as I had no emotional connection to it. For a while, I floated in the cavern and called out a mental, "Hello, anyone here?" There didn't seem to be. Aware I didn't have long to explore, I concentrated intently on the point between my eyebrows to see what would happen. As I did, the space around me rippled. I had the sense that I was creating feedback, that here, my mental focus had a similar effect to throwing a stone in a pond. It rippled the fabric of reality. A bright spot appeared near me, and I immediately focused in on it. It grew, transforming into something like a glowing lanternfish. It didn't pull my attention for long, because something important was happening just out of my vision. I felt the teaching presence again. It was slight, distance, drawing me to my right. I moved my attention, and with it, my head moved physically to the right. I had a brief moment worrying I would bump into the medic sitting beside me. As I moved my head, I crossed an invisible threshold. A vast landscape of breathtaking color and hidden meaning expanded in all directions. My breath caught in my throat. I felt stunned, rendered thoughtless by the incredible beauty of a galaxy of stars and planets and entities. Organic art, complex fractals shifting into huge alien cities, was everywhere. Whole worldviews took physical form, exquisite desire manifest in planet-sized questions and intricate natural landscapes. But for all the beauty and wonder, I felt a burning pain in my arm where the DMT was going in, and for a brief moment, I wondered if I was about to die. The DMT guided me through what looked like outer space, past huge planets populated by intelligences I didn't understand and that didn't seem to care I was there. Some of the planets seemed like beings in their own right, colossal entities living in the void. They were both fixed and fluid, vibrating with a cacophony of complex geometry. Welcome to the internet. Just as my dosing lured me into a realm I didn't understand, carnival of the internet lures us ever deeper as technology advances, and is becoming harder and harder to keep hold of each other's hands. The song Welcome to the Internet from comedian Bo Burnham's masterpiece Inside perfectly captures the predatory trickster quality of the internet. It's something that lures you in, overruns your boundaries, and tempts you with its shiny wares. Sung with the step-right-up swagger of a carnival grifter, the song presents the internet as a place that offers us whatever we want, anything that will fulfill our desires, but fleeces us in the process. Speaking with Catherine D. about how people experience intimacy online, I asked her what she thought we most often get wrong about the internet. She explained that we often forget that the medium is the message. We can't separate out how we're behaving from the environment that is influencing our behavior, a situation not dissimilar to the role of our setting during a psychedelic experience. To understand the internet and why psychedelic experiences are so well suited to helping us navigate it, we have to look more deeply at how the medium itself, our setting, affects the way we relate online. Sherry Turkle, a clinical psychologist at MIT, has spent 3 decades studying our relationship with technology. In her book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, she argues that the internet and our devices are making it more and more difficult to have intimate, honest conversations. She also argues that the internet has been intentionally designed to create a friction-free emotional life by tech designers and tech giants. Turkle's work points to a wider trend of the 2020s. Many are retreating into virtual worlds because the real world, defined as it is by crises and complexity, is too much for us. The most extreme example is the Japanese phenomenon known as hikikomori, which describes people who suffer from acute social withdrawal and retreat into games and online fandoms. A less extreme version can be found in Western cultures, in which people with professional jobs can now work online from home. Writer Mary Harrington has argued that this has resulted in Western elites engaging in a kind of luxury Gnosticism, which makes them retreat increasingly from the physical world of bodies and nature and into disembodied virtual worlds. These virtual worlds, Harrington argues, are defined by elite concerns and abstract concepts, disconnected from the physical and economic struggles of the majority of the population. It's a world where what we want to be true can be true, where identity is fluid and context is ever shifting. While it can be a confusing and chaotic realm, its carnival intensity is strong enough to bypass even the glaring reality of inequality, economic collapse, and the meaning crisis. But everything has its price. The friction-free emotional life Turkle identified and the retreat into online worlds in an effort to avoid our problems both have consequences. During my dosing, I was about to have an experience of my own that would illuminate to me what these are. So that's a little snippet of, as I said, the third chapter in the bigger picture. Thank you for listening. And what I wanted to do now is open up the conversation with my wonderful guests. And I'm going to go in kind of roughly the same order. And I wanted to ask Chris and Lisa, the study is, as I understand it, the DMT extended state study that I was just talking about is almost finished, as I understand it. And I wanted to just get a sense from both of you. Obviously, you're going to be writing more papers on it, and we're going to be, you know, hopefully lots of very well-received new scientific study. But I wanted to find out what was most interesting for each of you. What was the most surprising finding of that study for each of you? Something you didn't expect as you started this research. So I thought, Chris, maybe we could start with you.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And yeah, for the reading, that was a nice lead up into this, I think. I think one of the most intriguing things that were happening in the days that I was doing the interviews and just going through the experiences with the participants is how, especially when people were getting repeated doses, right? So you were part of also this first stage of the study in which people were not just having one extended DMT sessions, but they came in successive DMT sessions. And there was always an increase of dose in these sessions. There was a progressive increase of dose. So you weren't supposed to know that at the time. I guess now you can know because you're done with the study. But one of the things that I've become really interested in and really started questioning participants about is how do you develop skills to navigate the state? And one of those, as exactly you intuited, is attention. How is attention deployed? And more importantly, how can you cultivate ways of attention to better navigate the state and to better get something out of that experience? To somehow, I think, going back to what John was mentioning, how do we start developing forms of know-how and cultivation of potential ways that can be meaningful and helpful for human beings to navigate in these states? I concur very much with the notion that indulging in them just for possibilities of escapism are kind of meaningless. And I think in a way, that was something that was emerging, right? So this sense that at the beginning of the experiences that people had, they were pretty much passive observers. They were just being fully immersed in these alternate worlds and engaging with these entities and beings in a passive sort of fashion, having these strong ontological shifts, shocks, if you will, as well. This sort of like supermassive metaphysical event happening for people. But as people came back to the experiences, and I interviewed them right before the experience and after the experience, and asked about their intentions, I just started to see how there was a bit of a shift going on. At the beginning, it was all about curiosity. It was all about fun and the adventure of it all. And as things progressed, it was really kind of like honing into a specific sort of personally meaningful objective. At times, that became something from the search of a metaphysical question to something that was deeply more personal, a more autobiographical question that started to emerge. People started to somehow make sense of their experiences, weird experiences of encountering, I think, spiders in some cases and things like this, into personally relevant, family members and so on, in which there could be underlying conflict or underlying tensions that needed to be resolved. So this kind of developing of know-how, which is something that I've been really interested in the past, is something that, you know, I think we started to see, in which the weirdness of that DMT space started to become familiar. People were better able to start to navigate that weirdness. And I think with the right frame of mind, with the right context, I think people did get something out of those experiences that was meaningful. It wasn't just tourism, you know, experiential tourism, if you will. So I think that was pretty relevant. And I think in some cases, to some degree, hopeful when it comes to what we can do with the psychedelic experience.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Chris. It's just fascinating to hear it from your side. It's so immersive being on the participant side. And on that note, the wonderful Lucy Walker has just joined. Lucy is a super accomplished filmmaker, was the director and executive producer of How to Change Your Mind on Netflix. She's got a new film out that I just saw, which is really amazing, of Night and Light, about Iboga. And so Lucy was another participant on the study. It's kind of perfect timing that you're joining now, Lucy, because it would be really interesting to hear, if you're willing to share, just what it was like for you as a participant. And perhaps the same question I asked Chris, anything that surprised you about DMT extended state?
Great questions. Thank you. And sorry, I'm filming right now, so I couldn't join at the beginning. Well, so many things. Where to begin? I mean, it's funny because Chris was witness to this, but, you know, for me, when I was dropped in, it was very intense at the onset. I think the bolus, whatever, was really overwhelming, that high dose for me. I'm pretty comfortable with high dose experiences, but I think I kind of lost contact and was screaming or something like that at some point. I think I was about to be unplugged when I suddenly kind of said, this is great or something, didn't I, Chris? I mean, you were there. So I think the kind of first couple of minutes, because we were checking in every minute, I believe, or so, was very overwhelming. And then afterwards, I was really in it, and I really didn't want to come out of it. I was fascinated, and I suppose I never, you know, I've had lots of experiences with different medicines, psychedelics. I don't know what your language is preferred, but, you know, I'm very comfortable with and love, in fact, high dose psilocybin or ketamine or LSD trips, and I have had some really incredible 5-MeO and NMDMT experiences before. So I felt relatively experienced. I wish I hadn't been a little bit anxious. I was somehow I kind of psyched myself out, or I kind of forgot, and I had gotten anxious. Maybe that was what happened at the beginning, or maybe that dosage was just quite high with that bolus, so the initial bolus. But I hadn't gotten anxious, which I'm not typically for these experiences. I typically feel like this, for me, there's no such thing as a bad trip, because I'm so comfortable with even really the uncomfortable things. I find really incredibly meaningful and beautiful and important. So I've and spiritual and so forth. And I don't feel like I have a recreational sort of approach. I feel like I am very sort of more spiritually, or sort of something more inclined. For me, these are really reverent, kind of awe-filled consciousness sort of explorations, and perturbing my consciousness to sort of this extent was such an incredible privilege. I felt incredibly privileged that I was able to participate in this incredibly important, beautiful work. And I don't know, man. I could just chat for hours. I tend to not really relate so much of the content of the trip, because I find some of that a little bit less relevant for other people to listen to. For me, you know, I'm a very experienced meditator, so I feel like I'm often very aware of the I'm often very aware of the impulses for my brain to make narratives and meanings, and, you know, the passion for meaning making that our brains can give us. And so I tend to, perhaps because of that meditation kind of practice, have a little bias against taking some of the narrative invitations, like, oh my gosh, I'm in the aliens of calm, or I'm a privileged person because I'm having this privileged experience. And I could feel available a lot of narratives about the experience. I didn't have any particular entities, sadly, although I think my answer when I asked about that was actually, it was complicated, because we were all entities. I mean, I was so far out in terms of the, you know, it was just dazzled by the what even an entity meant anymore, and where I ended. I mean, it was just sort of, we were far beyond there being an I and there being an it and so forth and so forth. I've had entity encounters in other experiences. I didn't have something simple like that, but I think I did respond at one point to the prompts and saying kind of, it's complicated, because you know, it was all entities. It's just that there wasn't like a kind of creature over there. I was sort of in the, there wasn't a kind of cartoon character, which I've actually had with other experiences, like really cartoony kind of entity characters, but, or different kinds of entity characters, but it wasn't like that, but it did feel, anyway, so I could go on for ages. What should I talk about? Or perhaps it's time for somebody else to talk.
No, that's fantastic. There's so many things I want to pick up on that. And then you know, just on that point about meditation and also not meaning making, that was really core for me as well. I think a lot of my a lot of the training, I'd say call it training, I did before the dosings, which I did with Trish Blaine, who's here, introduced properly a little bit later. I was doing kind of weekly or bi-weekly sessions to kind of almost like astronaut training of like, okay, right, how am I going to cognitively and emotionally train myself, particularly for the bolus that you mentioned, the initial extra bit of DMT they injected, that was very overwhelming every time. It was a bit like smoking DMT, going from 0 to 1,000 very quickly. And I also found that, like, practicing a kind of radical agnosticism at pretty much every stage, whether it was, are entities real or not, whether it was, is this particular emotional content I'm going through right now, like, you know, how to engage with it fully, not landing too heavily anywhere, And I make the argument in the book that that skill is absolutely essential for good sense making in the world we live in anyway. And so it applies directly. It's just far more intense in a psychedelic experience. So I'm going to ask Lisa. Lisa, you were beside me in every single dosing, and actually really remembering one time in particular where I almost vomited, and you were kind enough to hold my hand, and a bucket appeared from somewhere. So you know that it's quite an intense thing to sit through with people. You know, and that's quite a feat. So for you, what most surprised you about the trial? You know, what were you not expecting?
Yeah, actually, interestingly, it's a similar thing to the thing Chris already mentioned about things somehow becoming more personal over the course of repeated dosing. But I feel like I also saw that over the course of one single experience. So it did seem like as time went on during dosing, people felt like there was more personal meaning in whatever they were experiencing, or at least they were, as Lucy said, putting a sort of like a narrative and meanings onto what they were experiencing. So that was quite surprising for me, given that DMT is mostly, I guess, approached as a kind of like a metaphysical exploration. But overall, what also, I guess, it wasn't surprising, but I guess, well, yeah, I think it's still worth noting that the experiences people had were very varied. So both in terms of how intense they felt the experiences were, but and also in terms of what material came up in the experiences. So yeah, some people did indeed have very personal experiences, but there are also experiences that were completely different. Some people had loads of, let's say, entity encounters, others did not. I think that's the second thing that I found really interesting to see.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you. Yeah, that's that personal aspect of it was the most surprising thing for me, certainly, just how biographical it was as well as metaphysical. So I want to zoom out a little bit away from for a moment from the DMTX trial specifically, and I wanted to ask you, Jamie. So it's very possible that many more people in the next 5 or 10 years or even sooner are going to have access to states like this. And you've written about this, you know, especially in Recapture the Rapture. Like, what I'd love to just hear your thoughts on, what does it mean for people to start in the mainstream having access to these very intense altered state experiences? Like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean that's the hoot, isn't it? You know, all of these actually psychedelically naive therapists running ketamine clinics, and you know, and I mentioned it in Recapture, but you know, the classic Hunter Thompson line from Fear and Loathing. You know, we were somewhere outside of Barstow when the drugs began to kick in. You know, and they've picked up a hitchhiker. Like, you know, like, no point in telling him about the bats. The poor bastard is going to see them soon enough. You know, so like, my sense is when are we going to fucking tell the Muggles about the bats? You know, or the machine elves? Like, we've lobotomized and sanctioned. We've all agreed to go along traipsing behind the MAPS banner of PTSD for veterans. Yay! You know, and an improvement for SSRI. But you know, our friend T. Ferry, who did a piece at the MAPS conference, a spoken word piece on the trickster element, like the Promethean trickster element of this stuff. It is super duper tricksy. And I think the only sane space, and John, you've been echoing this, but it goes back to Robert Anton Wilson and his concepts of reality tunnels and Korzybski's theories of general semantics, and that kind of just like maintain the trickster in this. And so if I could offer anything, it was sort of the cheat codes to hyperspace. So if it's okay, I'll just read them. There's 8. The game, and this is basically a way to navigate these phenomenologically rich to the point of overwhelming, you know, experiences while maintaining that agnosticism, right? So the game has an infinite number of levels in an infinite number of dimensions. The purpose of the game is to remember you are playing it. And the Greek term anamnesis, the forgetting of the forgetting. The more levels of the game you remember you're playing, the more fun and consequential the game becomes. Higher levels of the game can bleed through into 3D. They often show up as coincidences, synchronicities, or absurdity. This is a known issue and best taken as a reminder that the game is afoot and held loosely. This is where most New Agers go right the fuck off the deep end with the power of manifestation and the secret and all that kind of. They get a little bit of, you know, synchronous or black cats in the matrix, and they think that, you know, that they are the Cheshire Cat themselves. The 3D level is the access point to all the other levels of the game. If you die at the 3D level of the game, it is game over, unless or until proven otherwise. So no matter what, don't die in 3D. And to that, you could say, don't end up in an institution. Don't end up in a jail cell. Don't end up in rehab. Don't end up in divorce court. Don't do stupid shit. Don't, and this is all of CBT, NLP, and chunks of Western magic embedded in this line. Don't say anything or think anything that you don't want to become more true. Once you've figured out the game, help turn as many NPCs into players and as many players into architects as you possibly can. And last but not at all least, stay awake, build stuff, and help out.
Beautiful. Amen to that. Yeah, thank you, Jamie. Very necessary. So, yeah, wonderful. I'm going to, and Jamie, I know you have to go at the top of the hour, so it might be that we, as we go through the conversation, we don't see you, but I wanted to say, if we don't see you, I want to say a massive thank you as well, and thank you for that.
Well, and huge congrats, mate.
Thank you.
Big, and for anybody that hasn't already bought your copy, who's here and listening or coming across this at a later date, go out and get your copy. Ali put lots of blood, sweat, and tears and the Imperial team on sharing these things, and it's a fresh take that has not been spoken before. So please support the author, support the story, and share it wide and far.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Thank you. So, John. John, as a cognitive scientist, I'm very curious what you make of these types of experiences. And also, I wondered if you could speak perhaps a little bit around the concept of breaking frame and making frame, because it's really core to the book. That's part of what's going on with psychedelics. But aside from that, I'm also just quite curious, how you see the potential value or the potential downsides of these types of experiences.
As a cognitive scientist, I'm very interested in these experiences. So you made use of some terms that come from insight experiences. This is your aha experience when you do something like, oh, I thought she was angry, but now I realize she's actually afraid. And when you do the reframing, you change what is foregrounded and backgrounded, you alter what is salient and relevant. That's way too strong a thing for a scientist to ever say. I'm sorry. I don't know why that slipped out. What we have some good evidence and good reason to believe is that those processes of framing, making frame and breaking frame found in insight are you can improve them. You can develop more cognitive flexibility. You can also do the opposite. Many of you might have seen, and I suppose they're going to put it on my tombstone, the 9-dot problem. And it looks like an easy problem, joining all 9 dots with 4 straight lines. And of course, it turns out to be a very difficult problem, such that the statistical solution rate is not different from zero, spontaneous solution rate. And then, of course, all you have to do is go outside the box and then the solution is obvious and easy. But what's problematic for people is how powerful the box is. By the way, that's where thinking outside the box comes from. It comes from an experiment in 1981. And one of the important thing that we should know about this, which goes into show you how popular media misrepresents things, is what the experiment reliably showed is saying to people, think outside the box, does not actually help them think outside the box. It does not afford insight. It does not drive it, which is the wedge for a much larger question I have, where I'm interested in these non-propositional, non-inferential processes that must be at work when we are generating or failing to generate breaking frame And when we're making a new frame, when once we've broken a frame, it's not enough to go outside the box in the nine-dot experiment. You also have to alter and come up with a new pattern of relevance so you can solve the problem. And that's what I mean when I said I'm interested in these psychedelic experiences insofar as they give me insight into insight or into something like a chain of insights, which is what I've argued the flow experience is. And so as that's my primary interest as a cognitive scientist is because for me, that's a potential point of transfer. I really appreciated what Chris said. And I like the fact hearing that people moved into the procedural. They weren't they stopped being sort of overwhelmed by the bizarreness and the of the phenomenology, and they started to navigate. That's very interesting. I'm very interested as a what's called 4E cognitive scientist, how we like you have Tversky's work and a lot of other people work that we take the brain machinery by which we navigate the physical environment and we exapt it up into how we navigate the conceptual, the imaginal worlds. And so I'm interested about that. That's fascinating, about people starting to get the know-how of directing their attention and properly orienting, like Ali was doing in his description, and starting the navigation. And I'm wondering how much that will transfer and how much it might transfer to everyday experiences of insight. Because there's good reason and some very good evidence. It's not sufficient to build a consensus, but it's good evidence. There's not much counter evidence that if you improve the insight capacity properly, you also reduce self-deception. You reduce the degree to which you get locked inside inappropriate framing. And for me, that's the potential here. But I want to say something about that, which is, I might have related this story, so I'll do it very quickly. But when I was first doing Tai Chi Chuan, and I'd been doing it for about 3 years, and I was doing it very religiously in both senses of the word, and I was having all these amazing phenomenological experiences, the days when you're as hot as lava, and the other times when you're as cold as ice, and you're in the flow state, and it's so wonderful and amazing. And I was all fixated on that. And then I had people come up to me, my friends, and say, "What's different about you? What are you doing different?" And I asked why, and they said, "Well, you're much more balanced in conversation. You're much more flexible, and I hear you listening better and responding." And then I realized, oh, that's what was really important about this. Not all the wonderful, but that I had trained some skills that transferred out into my life. And then I've been starting to ask that question, what affords the transfer? And I'm coming to my point, so I appreciate everyone's patience. See, the thing about Tai Chi Chuan is it's built an entire philosophical framework around it called Taoism. Taoism is kind of the religion of flow. And that's part of what I meant by a sapiential context. I think we should, of course, train mindfulness. I think that's very good for reducing self-deception. But, you know, we're invoking terms like metaphysics and ontology and levels of reality. Well, you know, maybe when you're not in the tripped out state, do some work on metaphysics, on ontology, on levels of reality. Build your repertoire so that you have something other than just whatever intuitively comes up. I mean, we need to build more powerful, philosophically powerful and profound frameworks if we want to properly afford the transfer of these experiences. We know from the level of construals literature, if you want to transfer something one experience to another context, you have to have a fairly abstract bridge to do that. And if you stay locked at the concrete level of the specific phenomenology, you won't transfer well. And so I'm concerned by the fact that, you know, I think that I think we want to invoke these terms, metaphysics, ontology, reality, sense of realness. Here's a question. Here's a philosophical question. Normally, sense of realness is how well it fits into your everyday experience. That's why you regard dreams as not real. Why do people go into some of these experiences and regard those experiences as more real, even though they don't fit in to their comprehensive worldview? What is going on there? That's an important philosophical question. It has to do with what are the actual criteria by which we evaluate something's realness? We throw this word out there, but we're not doing the careful philosophical work about, well, but what are we doing with these terms? And if we're not doing that work together, we're going to be talking past each other, even though we think we're saying profound things to each other. And so I'm concerned, as a cognitive scientist, we should definitely be doing the neuroscience. We should definitely be doing the psychology. But I don't hear much about how, and this is, you know, those are two of the disciplines in cognitive science, but I don't hear much about how we're doing the philosophy that is actually needed if we're going to carefully invoke these terms of transfer, like metaphysics, ontology, reality, etc. So.
Yeah, amazing, John. Thank you for that. That's like one of the core questions for me, and what I kind of end the book with is looking at that. What is underlying the various crises we face right now collectively? And of course, there's no firm answer to that. But for me, part of the where it, psychedelics intersects with that question is what our conception of reality is to begin with. And interestingly, and maybe Chris, you could talk about this, and then I want to ask Lucy a little bit about bringing to the mainstream again, because I think this overlaps too. But Chris, this you've released research about how people, not everyone, but people tend to shift towards a more consciousness first view of reality through psychedelic experiences. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's quite relevant. And then we'll open to a Q&A in not too long from now as well.
Yeah, so essentially very much inspired by psychedelic culture, I did one of the, I think one of the first really experiment trying to look into how metaphysical views from people change after these psychedelic experiences, especially the first psychedelic experience. And to much of my surprise, I was hoping people would come more to a consciousness first view. Instead, I saw that, we saw that, you know, the evidence suggested that people tend to shift towards a more dualistic perspective of the world, and one in which both mind and matter, mind and nature have equal standing, and more importantly, there are different aspects of reality, which is kind of troubling in some regards. I mean, at least from the, you know, if you're trying to have an embodied mind sort of perspective on things in which you're trying to unify these two separate realms, but at the same time, you know, this idea that somehow we are intuitive dualists. We have, as John was saying, a world of dreams, and we have a world of physical reality that seems, at least from an experiential naive perspective, to be very real and quite separate. When you're fully immersed in dreams, you know, granted a sense of reality, unless you're having a lucid dream, which is in rare occasions. At the same time, we also found that panpsychism was stronger. There's apparent philosophical discrepancy there, right? So panpsychism, you know, the idea that the whole universe is conscious, is somehow closer to the idea, notion of idealism. So now there's further work trying to go a bit more into the nuance of these different metaphysical positions and how do they change after psychedelic experiences. One of the things that was quite striking in that study is that then we analyzed the mechanism by which these metaphysical positions changed. And we found that it wasn't just the psychedelic experience per se that was driving it, but it was also a socially mediated mechanism. So the more people were, you know, prone to suggestibility, certain personality traits, age, for example, all these things predispose people to a shift in metaphysical positions, as well as how much they feel that they were synchronizing with other people when they were having ceremonies, emotionally synchronizing with these other individuals, suggesting that there was this kind of like transfer of beliefs happening. There's a kind of like hyperfluidity of these belief systems happening in psychedelic sessions. The dark side of this, of course, the kind of like the negative conclusion that can be drawn from this is that psychedelics can also drive forms of mind or brainwashing, right? Increased suggestibility and the ghosts of cults that is ever present in the psychedelic experience. At the same time, you know, there's a vast sort of array of reports of people really being engaged more in meditation, and that they've kickstarted their paths in meditation via the use of psychedelics. And there's a strong sort of increasing overlap in the meditation literature and practices together with psychedelic literature and practices, indicating that, I think, suggesting, because there's many different kinds of meditation, but at least in the ones that, you know, are being proposed, kind of secular meditation that is being proposed is that if used properly, psychedelics can somehow allow a kind of like a bird's eye view on this of these different metaphysical positions, or if you will, a bigger picture. And I think that this is like the key element, right? So this is we coined this term with a couple of colleagues, psychedelic apprenticeship, is how do you develop psychedelic know-how? Specifically also around this specific aspect, how are we constantly immersed in these worlds of experiences, how we have implicit beliefs about the worlds of experiences that we navigate, how that will become increasingly challenging as we merge more and more with technology, with VR, different forms of VR, social media that is immersive, things that are increasingly being granted a sense of reality. So I think that the skill to be developed is really that form of bird's eye view, this capacity to be able to alternate between different modes of experience that are immersive, while at the same, while playing at the same time the game. So if you will, resonant with the Buddhist idea of the middle way, in which you are able to somehow recognize that on the one hand, there is no ground, there is no ultimate substance that we can refer to via direct experience, while at the same time not falling into the pitfall of nihilism, in which therefore everything is relative, there's no inherent value, and therefore my ethics and my morals can be completely depending on my own little rabbit hole.
Yeah, I love the concept of the psychedelic apprenticeship that you just raised. And then also just, which I might return to in a bit, I want to ask Lucy a question because that links to this as well. But, you know, just as a side point, you know, John's point around taking something that we learn in one state and then applying it to the real world, the experience of encountering seemingly intelligent entities, whatever they may be, in a DMT state, I think is incredibly relevant for increasingly encountering artificial entities online, as in AI chatbots, which are getting increasingly sophisticated. That's similar. It's a very similar process of discernment. And this is a very deep shamanic tradition of you don't know who to believe in these realms that shamans go to. They often report that.
Tricky story. Tricksters.
Yeah,
trickstery.
Exactly. Yeah. It's full of tricksters. You don't know like who to ally with. It's very similar to what we're now experiencing with AI. So, you know, I spend a good chunk of the chapter I read from earlier exploring that, because I think it's just fascinating. But Lucy,
Donald Hoffman, Conscious Agents, very interesting philosophically. Yes. But carry on. Yes.
So, I mean, you're sort of at the forefront of taking these profoundly metaphysical or experiences that can open people up to profoundly big changes in their metaphysics, and that also have the baggage of the 60s around them. Right. You know, Chris mentioned the cults, the weirdness, the sort of like slightly out of control aspect of psychedelics that a lot of the mainstream culture, perhaps increasingly less so, but certainly there's, you know, there's an association with that. Right. Now, for example, putting out something like How to Change Your Mind on Netflix, you know, probably the most mainstream expression of psychedelia that's happened in the last few years. What's your take on where we're at culturally with the mainstreaming process? You know, what's people's response been like? What do you think? You know, is there anything you think, hey, we need to do more of this, or people need more of this type of messaging? Yeah.
Gosh, you know, so much to say about that. And of course, recently I've been immersed in this new film about Iboga, Ibogaine. It's been fascinating as well. It's a sort of different story. What to say? Even I've got more to say about the DMT experience. I mean, I think that's the thing is,
yeah, say whatever you want.
No, I'm just like, I'm sort of fascinated by coming back to this. I think this is so cutting edge and fascinating as an exploratory tool. And I feel like, the How to Change Your Mind experience was fantastic. And it was a real opportunity to tell a very, introductory level kind of, don't be afraid, you know, these things can be healing. Look at these normal people and we're going to follow them through their experiences and they're not crazy. In fact, they find it very helpful. And look, there's an old lady who's never heard of psychedelics who's finding it really helpful for her anxiety about her cancer diagnosis, you know. And then we also have told, we're able to tell a beautiful story about Native Americans and their use of peyote and some just different really introductory level experiences, I think, to what's happening. Whereas I think this we sort of hinted a little bit at consciousness, but very, you know, gentle way. Whereas I think what we're doing here is going in a really, you know, asking some really, really good questions. I mean, I had so many questions that maybe I'm just getting warmed up to as well. I mean, I was really, it was really fun. And listen, like, those are the experts. I kind of want to listen to them, and they studied me. So I'm like, what did my questionnaires reveal about me? Good grief. But some of the things, the hyperbolic geometry, I mean, some of the things I was really struck by in this experience was, because of the exempt state, you know, you're really able to hold yourself in this condition. And actually, it was funny. There was one moment where the lunch, because they have lunch for you afterwards, or rather, I perhaps hadn't wanted lunch before because I don't know, I was fasting, but there was a kind of like, suddenly there was a kind of smell in the room, even if my eyes were closed, eye masks and headphones and the rest of it, you could suddenly smell like my vegetarian curry walking in the door. And so I was able to hold these two, you know, play the different levels of the reality of the game and kind of really hold them at the same time, which was kind of really fun. And I really didn't want to come out, you know, I was kind of really begging to stay in and turn the dials up as we approach the close. And yeah, I was really struck as well by, you know, we have some of our terms come from Henry James, right? I think it's about time we kind of really updated a lot of our language. And I think it's fantastic that these incredible researchers are in it these days, because I mean, some of the things, it, you know, that this idea of ineffable, you know, I think sometimes we can't articulate what we're seeing because we're not sophisticated mathematicians, you know, like some of this hyperbolic geometry is extremely exquisitely hard to describe for people. And how, you know, neuroscience is kind of suddenly giving us all these new tools to understand, you know, what we're doing in our brains here and a consciousness. And so I think there's a really, which isn't to say I'm going sort of super rational and dismissing the more far out things. But I think it's really fascinating to ask, you know, what is describable that perhaps just hasn't been described because so few people have had these incredibly privileged visits, you know, with such, I mean, I'm always just struck, even with a good IM ketamine trip, like how many people have really experienced those things and described them. And I'm fascinated by the work of our friend Andres. We're all at a retreat at the Tyringham, you know, Andres Gonzalez Emilson, what's his name, Eliasson, you know, this idea of doing a retreat where you're kind of constantly repeat dosing until you're actually really able to really articulate more about this experience. I was really fascinated by the noetic quality of my experience. That was a real phenomenon for me that I really, you know, and you know, there's this kind of story for me that was very available about here I am again in this, you know, level of the game where I've been before and I know it and they know me, and this is a familiar, and there's a, the whole of the rest of my life is rearranged from this vantage point, but this is the, you know, this is the privileged level, and I got to be in that portal and be there again, and what does that mean? And here I am. So it's really fascinating to me, this idea of noeticism and the realer than real, the experience of it being realer than real. And I'm really fascinated to kind of drill into, that's the wrong word, but to really sort of explore that philosophically and also just in consciousness, because it's such an acutely experienced story, as it were. And just the geometry of it all is really fascinating to me. And there's so many aspects of it that are fascinating, but it was really, after the initial kind of bolus sort of roller coaster drop of the first 90 seconds of screaming, after which I kind of emerged saying, no, this is great. Don't unplug me. This is the best thing ever. You know, that ability to really be so far in a high dose experience and yet also present in the room and aware of where I was at in this lovely, very beautifully held experience in the room with Lisa and Chris's team and Lisa and Chris and their team. So back to How to Change Your Mind. I mean, I think that was a different experience for sure that was really an invitation, I think, to the newbies. And I think Michael Pollan is such an exquisite, trusted, credible, you know, self-confessed nervous Nelly. So he's such a wonderful, you know, cautious and inviting and eloquent presence that I think people, you know, really encourages often psychedelic naive people to open their minds to first time experiences. And we really were very mindful of those, of that audience and that very precious opportunity to sort of preach outside the choir with How to Change Your Mind and reach this vast audience in so many countries and all the rest of it. So that was really wonderful. But quite a different enterprise, I think, than the one we're doing, which is just so such an exploration of, yeah. And I mean, I suppose I perhaps more experience. As I said, I was kind of, I wish I hadn't. My advice to some friends who've been in the experience since was just don't be afraid, because I wish I hadn't been afraid. I kind of want to do it again without somehow forgetting that I don't get afraid and I don't need to get afraid. I had somehow thought, oh my gosh, it's going to be more scary than my other experiences, which don't scare me at all. And then I think that, so I sort of, I think, anyway, I sort of would love to have the experience without that anxiety that was going to be overwhelming, which indeed, of course, was for a minute or two there at the beginning, a little bit self-fulfilling perhaps. But what else to say about all that? But it's fascinating to depict these experiences in, you know, audio and video, which is my job, while also really, of course, enjoying them for myself for so many reasons. Questions?
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. I mean, actually, a lot of what you were just relating there ties into some of the questions that have come in. And one of them, I think there's a bunch of questions here in the chat around how we navigate that experience, which I think is a really interesting thing for us to touch on. And I just wanted to speak to Kavan Ganapathy. I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, but I've tried my best. You've asked, do we have studies to correlate the ontological experiences between DMT states and the states mentioned in the Tibetan Book of the Dead regarding the no game and game states? I'm not aware of any specific studies together with that, but I would say that I found the model of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the world between life and death and the bardo and the psychology of that and what they explore really, really helpful in DMTX, because part of that process is that you're presented with all these angels and demons, and you have to keep your center and keep your sovereignty and stay connected to yourself and in a way see through the illusion of what you're being presented. And so that for me was quite similar to moments during the DMT experience, and I think is quite similar more broadly to the world we live in. These are kind of it's really essential skills that we need. And then Andy Hansen, you've asked a couple of questions, which I think a bunch of us can speak to, and you've asked a bunch of questions, so I'm going to choose one. And I think, so Andy's asked, what was it like to be conscious of both worlds simultaneously? My experience of using DMT or 5-MeO is that I have little to no awareness of my physical surroundings. Did you ever miss a check-in? I didn't miss a check-in personally. I think Lucy mentioned you almost missed a check-in there.
I missed the first one, I think. And then after that, in a way, actually, I kind of regret that I didn't go further into the experience. And I did really hold, like, sort of joking with the room or something about the curry, etc. Interacting with the surroundings, I kind of regret that I didn't. Perhaps that was born a little bit of my anxiety at the situation where there was sort of people all attending to me around me, and I was sort of trying to attend to them a little bit rather than just sort of
letting go and being kind of.
Perhaps, yeah, perhaps. I mean, but then again, it was for me again a real privilege of that extended state that. For me, there was a real opportunity to navigate really, you know, really to really hold those realities at the same time.
Yeah.
I am in this experience. My God, it's beautiful. And I'm, you know, having this entire chemical cascade of amazing kind of consciousness, you know, blah, blah. And visual and emotional beauty, et cetera, and meaning kind of flying around in a different way than it ever normally is, except for these other times that this has happened to me. And yet also being in the room with some researchers and. About like, you know, what is actually happening and all the different ways in which, you know, my brain wanted to make meaning of that. And my meditation practice kind of allowed me to sort of put pause in that.
That was really essential for me as well. The mindfulness practice of sort of decentering, of taking a step back from the content and being able to feel everything. So not dissociating from the experience, but being able to feel it. And actually, I think Trish, so a lot of the training I did was specifically around this question of how to hold multiple perspectives, but also in a way be in multiple states at the same time. So it was listening to the audio, being in deep in the DMT world, being embodied as well, and kind of holding that.
Also being able to answer. I mean, to have you, was it entities, yes or no? Intensity level, and Lisa's voice I can still hear, right? 1 through 10, entities, yes or no. You had that prompt with every minute. So you're really, there's a metronome
it helps you to decenter in some, it helped me a little bit. Also, one time I gave a rating of intensity and an entity I was communicating with was like, really, 6? Is that it? It was, so everything sort of mixed together. But Andy also asking about what single framework do you think is most essential for making sense of the psychedelic experience in a meaningful way? Which is a really tough one to answer because I don't think there's a single framework. And I think as John alluded to before, what we're missing largely, certainly in our, in the West, is a framework that can hold the psychedelic experience and can actually hold simultaneously the science and the metaphysics and the complexity of it. You know, whereas a lot of indigenous cosmologies, that works for them. They have, you know, deep, rich cosmologies that can make sense of and hold the experience, or is that something that we're sort of, largely missing and trying to figure out as we go. And then I just wanted to also speak to this question about what, Chris and Lisa, what's next? What next study? Because I think it would be quite interesting to hear. And why? What's next and why, I think, would be another other interesting side point of that. So maybe, either Lisa, maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah. So we have a couple of things lined up. One very interesting thing that we're going to go into is actually research with 5-MeO-DMT. So a molecule somehow very similar to DMT, but also on a kind of subjective level, very different. And we're actually going to run it as sort of almost like a comparison study. So trying to get almost the same participants into both studies and then comparing what is different between these two states.
Sign me up. Okay.
Yeah, I think I've already, I think I did the same thing this time and immediately said yes without thinking it through. But no, that's really amazing. It's really brilliant. And so I also wanted to just speak to Joseph Palmore. You've asked a really good, or made a comment in the chat, which is, I'm hoping the conversation could veer towards how this enhances authentic human connection and empathy for one another. And I absolutely agree with that. And I think this has come up a few times in the dialogue here, which is that these states and these experiences are valuable insofar as they help us collectively. In my view, yes, helping us personally is deeply meaningful and important, but we, anything that takes us away from the complexity of life and away from the complexity of actually dealing with our issues collectively and interpersonally is basically bypassing. So this is something that I believe in very strongly, that is essential, that the way we use psychedelics is linked to, I call it being rooted in the dirt while reaching for the stars, that we have the nitty gritty experience of being deeply human, deeply authentic, deeply in a kind of humility And at the same time, reaching for something beyond us. And actually, John, I would be quite curious to hear your thoughts on that, because obviously a lot of wisdom traditions try to tackle this very question. How can we not let these practices bring us deeper into what I think you might call foolishness or self-deception, but somewhere to a richer place?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that the West doesn't have a tradition for talking about different levels of reality and for processing this issue. I disagree. We do. And and Arthur Vosloo has argued very well that the spiritual backbone of the Abrahamic West, so I'm also including Islam and Judaism here, is the Neoplatonic tradition. And the Neoplatonic tradition has a millennia of working over these things, and it has deep discussions with Hermeticism, with magic, with Gnosticism, and also it's had very powerful discussions not only with world religions, reciprocal reconstruction, in fact, with Christianity and Judaism and Islam. It's also done that with science at both the first scientific revolution and also during the Einsteinian paradigm shift. So, and one of the things that's key there, and I recommend Drew Hyland's book on this, is Plato's way of doing philosophy, the dialogical, which is designed to always simultaneously remind us that we are finite and transcendent. And that if we only go for the transcendent, we fall prey to hubris. And so we have to cultivate virtues of humility. But if we only give into finitude, we fall prey to tyranny and servitude. And so we have to cultivate virtues of courage. And then, of course, we have to have cultivated the virtue of wisdom for appropriately balancing those and adjusting the relation as needed. So I do think there is a tradition. Now, I'm not saying we should all be Neoplatonists. What I'm saying is we should include Neoplatonism in the conversation because, like it or not, it is deeply inseminated into our cultural cognitive grammar in the West without even realizing it. Some of the terms we're using here have been drawn from that tradition. The noetic, and that, of course, comes from the Platonic and Neoplatonic tradition. And including that conversation could be valuable because, as I said, it's also a framework that helps to bridge between phenomenology and science, because it's done that repeatedly in the past, while also giving some more direct guidance about how do we maintain that proper balance between humility and courage, so that we are always keeping one hand on our finitude and our capacity for self-deception and for foolishness, and another hand on our capacity for self-transcendence that makes us capable of, well, these kinds of conversations, for example. Yeah. And I think that is part of what I mean by, when I said a philosophical training, I didn't mean just conceptual. I didn't mean just developing the concepts. I meant what it used to mean in the ancient world. I mean the rigorous cultivation of virtues that afford one to become wiser in a comprehensive manner. I think ultimately when we're talking about this issue of these two issues of navigation and transfer, and I would argue they're deeply interconnected. Mm-hmm. The better you navigate, the more likely you will transfer. I think we're talking about fundamental issues of orientation, sense-making, and overcoming self-deception, and keeping a proper balance between finitude and transcendence. And I think I don't see enough work being done about this framework. I see lots of work being done about, and again, good work. And I'm not dismissing or sidelining this work. I'm a cognitive scientist. I believe we should be doing the neuroscience. I believe we should be doing the psychology. I just think that if we don't balance it by a philosophical framework, then we are presuming that our intuition is a sufficient guide. And what the research shows on bias and self-deception is that's one of the predominant things that drives people into self-deception, that they believe their untutored, uneducated intuition is a sufficient guide. And I'm afraid we have a lot of cultural bullshit that promotes that idea. Go with your gut. Really? I can think of seven places in my life where I went with my gut and it was a disastrous thing to do, right? And that doesn't mean always go with reflective reason either. This is the point. You have to balance the finitude and the transcendence off against each other in a powerful way. And so I'm going to keep making this call. I'm going to keep calling people to action, right? Tap into your own philosophical tradition. Read What is Ancient Philosophy by Pierre Hadot. Enrich your capacity for, right, a framework of both theory and what Hadot calls spiritual exercises. I think that is paramount for what's happening here. And it's also paramount for, as Ali has said, the problems we're facing with internet and the advent of AGI, of which I've talked at length elsewhere, so I won't go into that.
Yeah, brilliant, John. Thank you. Thank you so much for having a firm position on that, I think, is really valuable. You know, there's one of my great concerns is the inevitable rise of new religions based around psychedelics, which I think will be disastrous largely. And so I may actually make the argument, maybe one of the more controversial arguments I make in the book is that we're better off reviving existing religions that are open to that, which is already happening. There's a group called Ligare in America who are reviving creating a Christian psychedelic tradition. But because there are deep, rich frameworks that are so deeply built into our cognitive grammar, as I think I've heard you talk about it, John, like that feels very important.
What's your beef with the recent evolutions of people's religious
religion? Well, like, because track record wise, it happened in the 60s. Almost inevitably, it led to abuse, and none of them really lasted. 95% of the communes failed. Mostly what happens is you get sort of narcissistic and sociopathic leaders taking over and effectively, I'd love to be proven wrong by seeing a single new religion that has led to a deep kind of expansive group of humans. Now, people gathering together for deep spiritual practice together in community, people should do whatever they want, but a structured religion, I think it takes thousands or hundreds of years at least to create the system of checks and balances to build a new institution.
I'd argue American Buddhism. Look at Ram Dass. I sort of feel like there's always a few sloppy, unskillful people that get a hold of such powerful medicines and are going to be unskillful with them. And I do think we're going to see some terrible, you know, horror stories of unskillful people with the staff and some, you know, all the things we're going to see and we have to take care around. But I also really trust this unfolding. I really trust the insights and the sophistication and the beauty and the glimpse of, you know, things and the beyond and the, you know, perturbation of consciousness and I do think about the American Buddhist, for example, and that sort of, you actually just trust people's own kind of experience centralized religion and the kind of potential for corruption in that, that's actually got its own pitfalls. Look at the Catholic Church, for example.
I agree that there are massive pitfalls, but American Buddhism is a good example of, there's an innovation. I think someone had the stream on. It's interesting because the American Buddhism, that's an innovation on an existing framework, you know, and it's not a dude opening a church in Denver and saying, we're going to do a psilocybin church here from scratch, with a value system from scratch. Like, there's a deep, rich tradition that, and I agree, centralized religion, I think, is that age is done in a lot of ways, at least in the form it was in. But I think the both extremes, I think, are hugely problematic. So the one extreme of I'm going to make a new religion and basically try and get my values from somewhere. C.S. Lewis said that we can no more think of a new value than we can imagine a new primary color, right? This idea that the values are at a deeper level that we access. And there's a very individualist bent of particularly American culture, but probably in the West in general, of yeah, like kind of make stuff up, make new religions up.
I don't know, though. I also sort of trust the insanity of that somehow, and the empiricism of that is kind of beautiful. And I think sometimes we sort of imagine and impose. I'm totally on thin ice. This is not something I'm especially expert in, and so forth. But I think sometimes I've just, from my observations, you know, it's people, I've just noticed that people often tend to really make assumptions about, for example, Bwiti or some of these, you know, spiritual traditions around certain psychoactives, and sort of imagine there's a 5-MeO classic example, and people really think it's been around for ages, and there's a whole kind of like thousands of years of, you know, a set thing around this thing, and there's no such sort of solid history, at least of course it's also hard to tell psychedelics history because it's been so repressed, but it's sort of interesting to think about that. And I kind of think there's going to be some really beautiful and incredible and positive things that come out of trusting that actually people, you know, I'd point to the 60s and say, yeah, you had a few, you know, kind of unfortunate sociopaths that got a hold of these things and whatnot. But you also had the women's movements and the gay rights movement, and you had a lot of really positive things that I think you can actually really directly attribute, it, in my view, to that kind of breaking of out of conventional things that and really opening people's minds sort of wider than we'd culturally been found it easy to do before. So I don't know.
I agree with that. I'm talking specifically about people creating new religions. So, but we are almost, we're just over time. So I want to wrap things up, and I like wrapping up on a sort of open question. That's always one of my favorite things to do. So firstly, I wanted to say thank you for everyone tuning in on the various different places this was streamed, and everyone who's in here right now as well in our lovely Zoom. Chris Timmerman and Jamie Wheel had to go a little bit early, so I wanted to say thank you for them in absentia. Thank you, Lucy Walker, very much. Thank you, Lisa Luan, not just for being here, but for being such a wonderful guide and
researcher. Coming up with the whole study, right? Yeah, Lisa, thank you.
So this would not be happening without you. So, and John, thank you for being here, and thank you for the tremendous impact your work has had on my thinking. It's I'm always grateful for that. So,
Thank you.
So you can buy The Bigger Picture on alexanderbeiner.com. You can just type in The Bigger Picture into Amazon or wherever you like to get your books. And thank you everyone for the lovely review so far. It's really been one of the most touching and amazing weeks of my life as people have been reading it and reviewing it. It's currently on 5 stars on Amazon. So if you want to review it on Amazon, that's hugely appreciated. Thank you everyone, and I look forward to seeing you all soon in some way. So
well done.
Yay. Thanks, bye.
Thanks so much. Thank you.